Welcome back to another fantastic and exciting episode of the Religious Studies Project. I'm Christopher Cotter. I am here with my two esteemed colleagues, Mr. David Robertson.
Hi.
And Mr. Jonathan Tuckett.
Hello.
And we are once again in the Wash Bar in Edinburgh. Joker IPA in front of myself, Joker IPA in front of
excellent
David.
Excellent pint, I have to say.
Yeah, good. And a half a glass of Coca-Cola with lime and ice cubes in front of Jonathan Tuckett.
Pure class.
Indeed. This week, we're bringing you a sort of standalone interview. It's not part of a series, though it follows on quite nicely from our Religion in a Global Context series. This is Professor James Cox of the Emeritus Professor James Cox of the University of Edinburgh talking about the problematic world religions paradigm. So we're really excited to be bringing you that interview. We just want to take a wee moment here to tell you about what's coming later in the week. Later in the week, David has been painstakingly piecing together a response to this from a variety of academics across the world. David, maybe you should tell us a bit more about that in case I get the names wrong. Wouldn't want to miss anyone off the list.
Yeah, what you mean is that you prefer if I get the names wrong because it'll interfere with your networking. When I first, I spoke to Jim about doing this interview about the world religions paradigm. We'd always sort of hoped to do it, but it kept coming up so often in things we were talking about. When we finally did it, I was speaking to Stephen Sutcliffe about it, and he said, you know, it'd be really interesting to have something about, you know, if we get rid of the world religion paradigm, what do we do, especially in a pedagogical context? How do you teach RS without using the world religions paradigm in, you know, for first years? And that sort of developed from there that I thought, okay, well, that we need to have that as a response. So we recorded a little bit with Jim, and then we had a few other interviews coming out, Mark Jurgensmeyer that seemed to fit, Peter Beyer, and then I asked Craig Martin to take part, I asked Suzanne Owen to take part, and Steve Sutcliffe as well. And the podcast that will be going out on Wednesday as a response is the result of that process. So I think it should be pretty interesting.
Just to add, I mean, one person that we would have loved to have had involved in that would have been Tim Fitzgerald, but unfortunately he's taken rather ill recently, so we would just like to take a moment just to send him our best wishes and hope that he recovers soon.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Tim would have been a great addition to that. Hopefully, we'll get him again on one of these edited podcasts again in the future.
Because the key question, it just comes down to, you know, a lot of the prevalent view is that first year undergraduate students want to learn about world religions when they come to the university, whereas we, the academy, are maybe thinking that they shouldn't want that and they should want something different.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Steve's contribution talks about that, about, you know, that actually if you try and replace it, then what happens is people don't go because they don't want to sign up for a degree and learn all about mystification. They want to go and they want to learn about Buddhism and they want to learn about Hinduism. But there are some stories, Jurgensmeyer and Craig Martin in particular, talking about trying to teach that first year course without using the world religions paradigm. And also Suzanne adds a little bit about teaching religions which aren't part of the world religions paradigm, you know, teaching things like Wicca, Druidry in her specific case, these kind of, you know, these kind of subjects and the problems of it. So I think people are going to enjoy this one. But for now, shall we go on to the Jim Cox?
I think we should. Cool. To you, Jim.
Few of our listeners will not have come across the idea, either as undergraduates or otherwise, that the religious traditions can be classified into varying number of world religions. Although this idea originated in the Victorian period, it is still the dominant motif in popular and pedagogical approaches to the study of religion. But is it, as Muller argued, simply how the vast domain of religion must be parcelled out? Or, as Terry Thomas put it, is it not so much a case of know thy enemy as know thy trading partner? To discuss the world religions paradigm with us today, I'm joined by James Cox, Emeritus Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Edinburgh and our first returning interviewee. So welcome back to the Religious Studies Project.
Thanks very much for inviting me back.
Well, you're quite welcome. So, a big subject, and I think, as usual, we should start with asking the simple question: what is the world religions paradigm?
Well, thanks, David. Obviously, a paradigm is a model or a pattern for anything at all, like an architectural design. So the world religions paradigm is a pattern or model for how religions have been categorized, classified, studied, and taught, probably in the main in the Western universities to begin with, and then it spread to other parts of the world, including Africa. The idea of the world religions paradigm is that we can classify or categorize religions according to their main beliefs, their main historical development, their scriptures, their founders, and put them into sort of one general or generic category. So classically, the world religions have been identified as religions of geographical areas, so Asia, North America, Europe, South America, Africa, and so on. But these have then, and Asia, of course, these have then been put into the main categories of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, sometimes Zoroastrianism. In Britain, it's very common. Sikhism is one of the main big six religions, as they call it. Chinese religions, Taoism, Confucianism. So when I first started teaching world religions, these are the categories that I used. Now, the problem that we have with the world religions paradigm is that it conveys to students that these religions or these classifications are self-contained, sometimes stagnant, quite discrete one from the other, and very much intellectually presented. So normally, in textbooks that deal with world religions, there will be a system or a section which deals with the historical background to these development of these religions. So you might have what happened in the early Indian period when the development of the so-called Dravidians in the south were sort of affected by the Aryans, and how the development of this term Hinduism, which has to do with the Indus Valley, came about. But the problem with this is then when I taught world religions using the textbooks, what we used to do, for example, with Hinduism, was to say things like, well, the main thing about Hinduism is contained, for example, in the idea of the Brahman, Atman, unity. Mm-hmm. So we said to students, Hindus believe that there is this great world spirit called Brahman, which is beyond our comprehension, and yet it is located in the inside, the deepest part of the human being, called the Atman or the self. So the individual self and the universal self are united in the Brahman Atman. So we taught this as Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Now I suspect if you go to almost any place in India and go on the ground to a temple and say, yes, the Brahman Atman unity is what your religion is about, they won't have a clue what you're talking about.
And they might argue with the term religion and even the term Hinduism anyway.
Well, absolutely. So the point is, what I'm making is, it's that you have these isms that have been developed, and we teach them largely, or have taught them, and many of the textbooks are the same way, taught them according to these rather westernized, intellectual, elitist ideas. Yeah. Now, if you take the idea that these religions are discrete, that is, separate from one another, can be classified in terms that follow certain descriptions derived largely from a Western Christian interpretation, we can see how they developed. So what is the belief? What are the main beliefs of these religions? And usually then there are questions about what are their beliefs about God? How do they conceive the ultimate? Then there are questions about how do they practice this in terms of their authoritative sources? And usually there would be scriptural traditions. So traditions that have scriptures and doctrines or beliefs. Then sometimes, not always, but founders were important founders. Then you get into certain things like rituals, but those presented less significance, I think, than were the main historical founders, doctrines, scriptures. Now, I'm speaking here, of course, stereotypically, about the way religions tended to be studied on the world religions paradigm. So we have these main religions that are identified. They are somehow discrete from one another. They are defined in terms of fundamentally concerns that are typically Western Christianized ways of looking at religion, and then imposed as if on students and scholars and other people in the general public, that this is what we mean by the term religion and world religions. Now, the other thing about the term world religions suggests also, and I think this is a point that's made by Jonathan Z. Smith in his book Map Is Not Territory, that the dominant idea of the religions being defined by Western concerns relates to issues of power. Mm-hmm. And this means that the religions which interacted with Western religions became those of concern to Western scholars. So, of course, you have the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic context. These three, Judaism, is important, not because perhaps of its numerical importance or well, of course, you could argue it has a very big import in the world, but because of its relationship to Christianity, Judaism, Judeo-Christian, and then Islam, of course, when you're taking it from a Christian point of view, is a sort of continuation of the prophetic tradition. So you have these three. These were put in. But then you have religions like Hinduism, which came into contact with Western scholars largely through the impact of colonialism, and then in the 19th century the missionaries were very strong in India, encountering the religions of the Vedic traditions, which they thought would then be absorbed or taken over by Christian traditions and Western philosophy, which they regarded as superior to the Hindu or Indian traditions. So, but you have then, as Hinduism came into a kind of power relationship with the West, it became an important religion to study. So F. Max Müller, of course, talks about the sacred books of the East, and he has this whole idea of how fundamentally important these Vedic traditions are in response to the notion of the deity or God or the relationship to the Western world. So this is Smith's point, I think, that as these traditions encountered the Western traditions, they became incorporated into the whole discourse, which was called world religions and the world religions paradigm. Primitive religions, as they were called, or animistic religions, or religions...
Fetishes.
But these were regarded as not very important, and they were regarded as dying out, that as they came into contact with the superior world cultures and their religious expressions, as well as their economic and political and philosophical traditions, governmental traditions, and so on, these would then be receding in importance and eventually would die away. And so they were not considered, apart from many of these books, a short section on the primitive religions as a sort of prehistoric religions. Mm-hmm. Then you have this section, but then you have the main religions, which are defined in terms of their encounters with the West. Now, parenthetically, I think that some of these religions of Africa and South America and the so-called primitive areas have become important for Western scholars because of their development of so-called syncretistic movements or new religious movements, where they have become very important players African independent churches or African initiated churches became important. Neo-Pentecostalism in Africa. We just heard a lecture from Bettina Schmidt about Candomblé and Ubanda in Brazil. These have become important players. And if you follow Jonathan Z. Smith's argument, they're important because they've increased in power relationships with the West, and the West has to take note of them.
Yeah, and I'd like to go back to that the sort of post-colonial critique a little bit later on when we get into how the world religions paradigm is related to the development of the discipline of religious studies and the comparative religion model and stuff. But for just now, maybe you could go a little bit further into the... You mentioned already the sort of colonial context, the Darwinian scientific... evolutionism kind of context, but the third of what Terry Thomas called the mixed motives behind the world religious paradigm is the theological context. And we've sort of touched on that already when you talked about how we defined these world religions in terms of founders, beliefs, gods, and very sort of philosophical systems. And maybe you could elaborate slightly on this kind of theological presuppositions that maybe came into the model.
Yes. What often is referred to with respect to the theological interpretation is a term bandied around called essentialism.
Yeah.
That is, there is the idea, based on a kind of liberal theological perspective. It was liberal theologians who were interpreting comparative religion, like Thiel, for example. So what we have with the idea is that there is some sort of universal core, some sort of transcendental source which all human beings somehow tap into and express in various localized, culturally relevant ways. So the idea of many, as Tomoko Masuzawa says in her book The Invention of World Religions, that many of her students in North America still to this day go into studies of religion courses because they believe that they're just various ways up the mountain where it's all to the very same end and from the same source.
Yeah.
So the idea of world religions, as it's often interpreted by certain liberal theologically inclined scholars, even if they're religious scholars, religious studies scholars, like, for example, Iliada, who has the idea of the sacred, the unknown and unknowable, which he got from Rudolf Otto, largely, so who was a theologian. And so you have the idea that there's this core, this essence, this source of religion. And what we do then when we study religions is study the way in which it manifests itself. It makes itself known in all sorts of different ways. So if I studied, for example, an African religion in Zimbabwe, on this model, I would be studying the way in which this localized culture was tapping into the common source of all religiosity experienced by humans everywhere. And that is, in some senses, a kind of a veiled, surreptitious theology. Now, for example, let me just take refer to Wilfred Cantwell Smith.
Please do.
Wilfred Cantwell Smith, in his book The Meaning and End of Religion, which was published, I think, first in 1963 or 62, criticized the term religion. He thought it was a reified, objectified, impersonal term which grew out of the Western Enlightenment, invented by Western thinkers who wanted to create this thing called religion, into which, as we developed in the 19th and early 20th century, into which you can fit all the various religions of the world. So his argument was that at the core of what we now call religion is personal faith or piety or devotion or some sort of experiential element. But this has now been taken out by the increasing objectification and intellectual studies of religion to make it into a kind of thing, to reify it. It is an object. So we study not Hindus or people who live in India who practice and experience religion in certain ways, we study Hinduism. Or not people who live in China or in parts of Southeast Asia and so on, who might practice variations of what we mean by Buddhism. Mm-hmm. But we study Buddhism, and perhaps you have different forms of it, like Mahayana or Theravada and that sort of thing, but you study it as an object. So Cantwell Smith was trying to critique this notion that you had religion and objectified religions and so on, mm-hmm. by inserting the personal faith element into it, and the kind of idea that we can somehow only understand religion if we can penetrate into the personal faith of the adherent or the believer. Now, the problem, of course, for Cantwell Smith, as for anybody who studies religious experience, is that penetrating into it, personal, private experience, is very difficult, if not impossible, to do. So, Cantwell Smith admitted this. Personal faith is entirely personal. But it manifests itself. We can see it. Mm-hmm. We can observe it. We can somehow describe it. And then we can classify it according to certain ways of descriptions that can be compared. So he likened it to two lovers. And they look at the moon. And the moon, of course, means many different things to different people. The moon can be described in astronomical terms as a satellite of the Earth, which follows these scientific patterns. But for Cantwell Smith, he says, to two lovers, it means something very different. Mm-hmm. It's emotive. It's sensual. It's somehow bringing the lovers into some sort of relationship, of which the moon is a sort of medium for this relationship. So, but we say then, okay, now these two lovers are experiencing their own personal love. Mm-hmm. Now, as an outsider, I can only look at how they express their love. I can't really enter into it, really understand. I can compare it to my own empathetically. Yeah, yeah. I can say, oh yes, I've experienced love. I don't know if it's the same as yours, but what I can do is say, how does this person treat his or her lover?
Okay. Yeah.
And you can begin to observe these expressions of love. Well, the same, he says, in terms of religion. What you can do is observe the way personal faith expresses itself. And then you can begin to study this in communities and begin then to classify or categorize the way that these expressions can be compared. So you create things like myth or ritual or religious practitioners or community involvement or law or sort of things like that. So you end up then studying not the personal faith, although you recognize it's the source, the locus, the fundamental focus of religion, but nonetheless you study it. Now, behind all this for Cantwell Smith was somehow how the cumulative tradition, the historical development of religions, came into the expression of personal faith in these various ways. You compare them historically and in their phenomenological categories. But behind it all for Cantwell Smith is transcendence. Yes, transcendence. And I think it's in his book, Towards a World Theology, he sets out the idea that it's windows onto transcendence.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The religions of the world, the personal faith which expresses itself in different ways culturally and historically, has its view towards transcendence, and by implication its source mm-hmm. is transcendence. So here we have a scholar who has critiqued religion and the world religions idea, but affirms the theological source
yeah.
of religion. And in that sense, confirms the idea that religion is, in fact, at its core, a theology.
Yeah.
A study of religion in a liberal sense, liberal Western, ecumenical sense, as Timothy Fitzgerald calls it, a kind of way in which we can discuss the way the transcendent is experienced in multiple ways, culturally and globally.
Okay, so what we're talking about here is this sort of application of the world religions paradigm in this sort of comparative sense. This is really the beginning of you know, comparative religion as a discipline. And still today, when people ask me, you know, your religious studies, what does that mean? Are you training to be a priest or whatever nonsense they come out with? I often say, no, I do comparative religion. And they go, oh, okay, I understand what that is. Now, so what's the relationship of the world religion paradigm to the establishment of religious studies as a discipline, not only here in the UK, but around the world? And we'll broaden it out perhaps afterwards. But, I mean, the first, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first religious studies proper course, as we would recognise it, was comparative religion, wasn't it, under Ninny and Smart at Lancaster?
Well, not quite. In fact, the first religious studies department of its kind, as we know it today in the United Kingdom at least, was founded in Ibadan in Nigeria in 1949. Geoffrey Parander, who became then the professor of comparative religion at King's College in London, was one of the first lecturers in religious studies in Nigerian Ibadan. And what Parander did, he followed on also in London, was to develop the idea of we compare various religions. And in Nigeria, and he did research in West Africa generally, he taught a course on religions in a way relevant to the constituency to which he was addressing. So he had a discussion or study of Africa's three religions, Christianity, Islam, and ATR, or African traditional religions. But he taught them in a way which is exactly what we mean by the world religions paradigm. Yeah. Islam is a religion, it's discrete, self-contained, its own history, its founder, its scriptures, and so on. Christianity, the same. An African traditional religion, notice in the singular, is also taught in a way that examines things like its beliefs about gods, or God, actually God, the supreme being. And then you have power, spirits, rituals, activities, and even demons, or evil spirits, and that sort of thing, witchcraft, all which falls under these categories or classifications whereby we can compare and study. So it was a comparative study, indeed. What is the belief about God in Islam, in Christianity, and in African traditional religion? Are they the same? Are they similar? How do they relate? What is their belief about, what is their authoritative source? Of course, in ATR, as he called it, you have oral traditions. But you also have, particularly in Nigeria amongst the Yoruba, you have the Ifa divination system, which is also, although oral, is also a very specific and detailed way in which the diviner can tap into the authoritative source for determining whatever people are asking about this. So you had this comparison, the source of authority, Quran, the Old and New Testaments, and in some senses the oral myths and traditions which are conveyed authoritatively in the African traditional religion, as he called it. So you have this comparative. Then he did the same thing at King's College in London. But of course, then he wanted to look at other things. So broadened it out to other religions. And he looked at, for example, I think he had one book dealing with sexual ethics or sexuality in the world's religions or something like that. But he set this up. So Parander was one of the pioneers of what we mean by contemporary establishment in universities of comparative study of religions. I mean, it goes further back than that. You had, for example, J.N. Farquhar, who I think was at Manchester in the 1920s. He wrote the important book, The Crown of Hinduism. Oftentimes he wanted to compare religious beliefs or beliefs about God, scriptures, the source of authority, the way in which rituals are undertaken in Hinduism and Christianity. So you have these comparative things going
Fraser
on.
Maybe.
Well, J.G. Fraser, of course, but religious studies, as we know it in the UK, was founded in 1967 at the University of Lancaster by Ninny and Smart, and the first department of its own, which was not associated in any way with a divinity or theological faculty entirely to be the academic study of religions. Now, Smart, of course, is well known prior to his founding this for his own interpretations of religion, and if not the first, one of the first books he wrote was The Religious Experience of Mankind, in which he sets out the way in which we can compare religions, not so much on the idea of world religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and so on, as according to the dimensions of religion, what he calls dimensions of religion. In his first book, The Religious Experience of Mankind, he deals with the mythic tradition, the legal tradition, the ritual tradition, and so on, and he gives the experiential the priority, which, like Cantwell Smith, was, in a sense, to say religion must be understood from the point of view of the one who experiences it. Now, of course, he wanted to put into this particular studies of experience of religion, even going back to William James, the variety of religious varieties of religious experience. And nonetheless, he emphasized experience. In his later books, one called Dimensions of the Sacred, he doesn't do that. He puts it as one of the, what he calls, double barreled dimensions of religion, doctrinal and belief for one, but they're not the most important or necessarily to be elevated over others, ritual, myth, and so on, the ritual practitioner, including the legal and community aspects, and then he has experience as one of these. But by the dimensions, he wants to compare across more phenomenological categories. So, for example, if you take the idea of the mythic dimension, then you can talk about how myth operates in all these various kinds of religious traditions. Then Smart runs into a problem. He says, well, now, we have what have sometimes been called quasi-religions, like nationalism, Marxism, Freudianism, and that sort of thing, which are not usually classified as religions, but have these same dimensions. So he gives in the dimensions of the sacred, he talks about American nationalism, for example, and he says, well, you have the mythic tradition about the founding of the nation, George Washington, I would never tell a lie, and that sort of thing, these myths that are told. You have the ritual dimension, every day in school, the children look to the flag and they put their hand of their heart and they say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and so on. This is the ritual. You have the monuments, legal, you have monuments, artistic, that's another thing, the artistic dimension, which you have like Mount Rushmore, and you have these presidents engraved on the hills, the Black Hills of South Dakota, and so on. So you have, but he said, now, is this a religion? And in the end, Smart says it's not a religion, it is a world view. So what distinguishes a religion from a world view for Smart? It has to be what he calls in The Phenomena of Religion, 1973, the focus of faith. And the focus of faith is somehow, for a religion, transcendent. For worldviews, not transcendence. Now, Timothy Fitzgerald has pointed this out quite clearly in his book, The Ideology of Religious Studies, where he critiques Smart for this point. In his defense, Smart says, well, what he's saying really is that a Marxist, even though he has all the dimensions of religion, does not call himself or herself religious. It is not a religion, according to a Marxist or a Freudian, or even a nationalist, even though it might have all the characteristics of dimensions of religion. So Smart said he wants to respect the viewpoint of those that are upholding this, and only those that call themselves religions. But do they call themselves religions?
Exactly.
That's the point. So I think that argument falls, and the point, and I think Fitzgerald's critique stands, that even for someone like Ninian Smart, it is transcendence or surreptitious theology, which nonetheless defines what we mean by a religion in the first instance, and then religious traditions. I don't think Smart nor Cantwell Smith ever escaped the idea that they still had to talk about religions in some sense. Mm-hmm. And so even in his little book, The Faith of Other Men, Cantwell Smith, who's trying to talk in this book about the fundamental core, the focus, the locus, you might call it, of these religions for a popular audience, nonetheless talks about Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, mm-hmm. and Chinese, which, because he says that's the yin-yang coincidence of opposites that defines the core element for us understanding Chinese religious philosophy. But anyway, point is that I don't think Cantwell Smith escaped this, and I don't think Ninian Smart ever escaped it, because he still had to talk in terms of these world religious traditions and the dimensions which exist within each. The dimensions were comparative, but they existed within traditions which he had to call the religions, at least of Asia, Southeast Asia, or India, or Africa, or so on.
To go back to Parinder for a minute, the world religions paradigm was used in a apparently more benign way in the what you might call the post-colonial period, as our understanding of indigenous traditions improved. Would that be fair to say?
Well, the post-colonial critique, for example, David Chittister in his book Savage Systems outlines the history of the study of religion in South Africa and how religion became a tool for basically the oppressor. First, the African had no religion. Well, first they had a relationship to, I think, Egypt or whatever, or even Israeli traditions of some sort in some far-fetched way. Mm-hmm. But then they had no religion. Because it was convenient then to have no religion, mm-hmm. because they didn't have churches, they didn't have scriptures, they didn't have anything that they would call religion in a Western Christian sense. But after that, then, what's quite interesting in Chittister's critique, I think, is that the awareness and the recognition amongst the South African colonialists that there really was religion. Mm-hmm. And this religion then, and this also could be put to certain Christian African leaders, this religion could be accommodated into Christianity. It could be used, in a sense, as a tool to make those that had been colonized very much fitted into the whole concept of what it means to be a good citizen, a respectful kind of participant in society. I remember looking at a Church Missionary Society Intelligencer report from one of their journals in 1869, in which it was discussing in Sierra Leone the way in which the Christian converts in Sierra Leone had become good citizens. They're dressed properly, they work hard, they contribute to the society, they believe in God, and in every way they have been elevated out of their darkness and their degradation, as it was put in this journal. Now, of course, this was set against, in their view, the view of anthropologists of the day that the African wasn't even a human. But that's another story. The point is, however, that once that they were accommodated into Western ways and could be Christianized, or at least fitted into a Christian ethical framework, then their own religion could be used for purposes of making them, civilized or Westernized. Then you have the very interesting change, I think, where the African or the indigenous Christian leaders now begin to say, and even Parinder, who wasn't himself obviously African, argued that, wait a minute, all this degradation or denigration of the old religions the traditional religions, the pre-Christian religions, which have now been superseded by the superior Christianity, is in fact very degrading to the indigenous people. So what we need to do in this case is to discover the values, what the highest aspirations, the best elements of these pre-Christian religions. And what do we find? What do we find? We find they believe everyone in a supreme being. They all believe in God. And this God is a creator God. Mm-hmm. This God, well, strangely, resembles the Christian God. Yes. And in this sense, they, that is, the indigenous people, have become all right, mm-hmm. acceptable. Yes, because they are not just like us, but close enough to us to be acceptable to us.
Yeah.
And then all we need to do is now is make a little shift from their, the things about those pre-Christian religions that were, well, not very nice, like witchcraft and believe in spirits that are evil and all that, and just eliminate those, but take those ideas of their supreme being and their elevated moral status and then make them into good Christians. So in this sense, people like John Mbiti or E.B. Idogo, Mbiti was Kenyan, Idogo Nigerian, and before them the missionaries Edwin W. Smith and Jeffrey Perrender all held this view that we need to recover the value of the pre-Christian religions in order to make them somehow acceptable, and the values that they saw were very, very resemblant of Christian values. So this is another way in which I've got on the African example, but we could do this also in India, mm-hmm. about where you have the missionary movement in the 19th century changing from criticizing, and like Alexander Duff, the Scottish missionary, said, well, we must replace the Vedic scriptures with the Christian scriptures, Hindu philosophy with Western philosophy, Greek philosophy, and then we'll have India will become the new sort of paragon for a society that has been Christianized through and through. Of course, that didn't work. And when that happened, you have people like Farquhar, whom I mentioned, who developed the fulfillment thesis that what we have to do is now see the best, the highest aspirations, the greatest strivings in Hinduism, and they will be fulfilled in Christ. And so instead of saying, well, we have the old idea that the old must be replaced by the new, then the old is fulfilled in the new. Mm-hmm. And so you have this same thing happening in other parts of the world, where the Christianization process is a process which is very much to do with colonial power and colonial imposition of a worldview on top of that which is already being existing. Mm-hmm. Now in India, of course, a very different circumstance of Africa, other places of the world, but nonetheless, I think the way religion was used as an instrument of power as part of the post-colonial critique, and we see it in some of the, as I said, in the Perrender and in Mbiti and in Dogu models, you see it operating in what seem to be enormously docile and non-harmful, quite sympathetic ways, but in a way it's the worst kind of treatment, because rather than saying we value your traditions in their own right, we only value them insofar as they conform to our values.
We could talk for a lot longer, I'm sure, but we have run out of time again, so I will say for just now, thank you so much, Professor Cox.
So you've just been listening to David speaking with Professor Jim Cox there, and as we were saying beforehand, we've also got the compilation podcast coming up on Wednesday for you, so please do tune in again for that, if indeed it hasn't already passed. But now, what we want to tell you about is we've got a new series coming up on the psychology of religion. But before we... well, we're not going to really introduce that series. We're going to let our colleague, Chris Silver, do that. Chris, it's been taken on as another assistant editor for the project, and David and I recorded this conversation with him a little bit earlier.
Well, I'm Christopher F. Silver. I use the F initial because there's another Christopher Silver in the field of academia who publishes, and so I try to make sure I distinguish myself from him as much as possible, although he does research in sociology of urban development or something, but that's fine. So I of course, have primarily studied in the field of psychology of religion, although I have two master's degrees, much like Chris does. I've got a master's degree in research psychology with a focus in psych of religion, and then I also have a master's in religion and culture from Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario, Canada. So I am cross-disciplinary. I do qualitative and quantitative research, which in American psychology is, I don't want to say controversial, but it's certainly, there's a lot of psychologists who want to believe they do pure science, and I don't want to shake the boat too much, but I do use a variety of methodologies. My specialization areas, again, are right now I'm doing my dissertation on non-belief in the United States and trying to see if I can create a typology of non-belief, looking at a variety of metrics related to personality, emotion, intelligence. A couple of those things, we're currently in the data analysis part of that at the moment. I also have done studies in the field of religious deconversion, why people leave religious traditions. Now, typically do a lot of my research internationally. I believe in international collaboration wholeheartedly. I think a lot of researchers miss the boat if they only focus on a specific geography or country. So, and so I guess if I had to make it in a nutshell, make it easy, my research areas are atheism, non-belief, spirituality, authoritarianism, new religious movements.
Apart from the fact that you're in the States and we want to, you know, make the religious studies project much more international, the other thing that we found interesting about you was the fact that you're doing psychology of religion, which is something we hadn't really touched upon at all and yeah, wanted to. So you've kind of done a few interviews in that field for us coming up in the next few weeks. Maybe you want to set up that field a little bit for anybody
yes.
who doesn't.
Yes. I mean, psych of religion, it's really a growing field now, but to kind of juxtapose it historically, a lot of folks look back to the writings of, at least in my specific circle of colleagues, we look back to William James and the varieties of you know, religious experience.
Which was presented here at Edinburgh University, of course.
Yes, of course, absolutely. and then, you know, there are some other colleagues who come out of the clinical perspective that may also look to Freud, Carl Jung. But, there, you know, there's no real founder, if it were, of psychoreligion. More a variety of personalities that have sort of contributed to the field. And then what we see is, you know, following sort of the great theorist of psychology, we sort of see this lull in the field. There wasn't really a lot done in the study of psychoreligion, although there are some early works in the early 20th century. And then we start to see in the 60s and 70s this resurgence of the field. And an interview that is also upcoming that I just conducted today, actually, with Dr. Ralph Hood. Ralph Hood is probably one of the key personalities. We've also, there's a variety of other major scholars in the field of psychoreligion, such as David Wolfe, who is a sort of, one of the things I like about David's work is that he sort of has this movement back towards grand theory. Like, for example, Ralph, Paul Williamson, Heinz Streib, Leslie Francis, Michael Nielsen, Gorsuch. Let's see. I mean, there's a long list of major names. You know, Spilka. Anyways, you know, Peter Hill, a whole group of gentlemen and ladies who have not only sort of given more breadth to the field of psychology and religion, but also have given us a variety of alternative ways of thinking about the field. And of course, what's interesting about psychoreligion now is most recently in Division for 36 of APA, that's the division of APA that specifically focuses on the sort of social science study of religion in the American Psychological Association. There's recently been a push to change the name from the psychology of religion to the psychology of religion and spirituality. And so this idea that we're trying to also move away from the idea that somehow profound experience needs to be religiously interpreted, that the ontology of religious experience is solely within the bounds of denominational and theological phenomena, if it were.
That was Chris and I talking to the other Chris, Chris Silver, earlier on today, and the Psychology of Religion series starts next week with an interview with Heinz Strybe on faith development theory.
And we have just been listening to Jim Cox talking about the world religions paradigm. As always, we appreciate any comments that you might have on the website. We're also on Facebook. We always appreciate a good like. We're trying to achieve 1,000 likes as soon as possible, and then we can celebrate it. We're also on Twitter, if you'd like to follow us on that. You can download our interviews from iTunes, as always. And also, there's the Amazon affiliates. If you use us to buy books from Amazon, that always contributes to the RSP, and then this way we get to stop harping on about it every single week.
We're going to have to, but we've had some good results, so thank you very much.
Yes. And while it does help, we still appreciate the BSR's funding as well.
Absolutely. Who wants to say it?
So on three, and then are we doing sort of Lethal Weapon? It's on three or three. It's right, one, two, three. Then right, place us.
Okay.
Okay. One, two.
Thanks
three.
For listening.
Right, try again. One, two, three. Thanks for listening. Right, let's go. One, two, three.
Thanks for listening.